Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
The other day I got a call from a reporter, a nice fellow named Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business. Crane's is a good news source. My buddy Jim Kirk runs it. What Dennis wanted to know was how we sold our house in the suburbs and moved to the city. Oh, Jesus. Really? I mean, I'd already written about it. It was in the Tribune, you know? The Tribune, Dennis. I said, I've already written about it. You know, I'd gone on about the Shire and all that, but I don't live in the Shire, and there are rats in the alley, and Zeus looks for political signs to pee on when he has to go. Especially if it's an alderman sign. But I didn't tell him all that about Zeus and the rats and so forth. I just sat there and just kind of whined, like, hey, man, do you really want to write about this? And he said that he wants to know what neighborhood we are in, and he wants to know, did we buy the three flat or renting? And my real estate agent, a woman named Georgia Kass, K-A-S-S, is she a relative? So I'm on the other end of the phone, and I just let it hang there. Didn't say anything. Her name's Kass. Figure it out. She's my sister-in-law. She's married to my brother, Pete. But I said nothing. But then I said, I wondered, why would they even bother treating me like a celebrity? I don't like that. I don't think reporters should be celebrities. And then it's like, if you're asking me about did I buy the three flat? Do you want to see it? Should I show you pictures? It's like MTV Cribs or something. Or maybe the lifestyles of the not rich and not famous columnist who gets his ass kicked on social media by angry lefty trolls who want me fired. That's a long title for a show. And who'd watch it? I mean, if I was really getting my ass kicked, somebody would watch. But it would hurt. Dennis said the reason why he wants to do it, this story, is because, well, they do stories on media people and the prices of their homes and what they sold it for, where they moved. I said, but I've already written that. And I didn't leave the area. I didn't leave the state like I should have. I moved into the city of Chicago, my hometown, just when everybody else is moving out. But he wanted to write, and I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, really? Look, Dennis, I said, I don't want people knowing where I live. I'm private. I don't want Betty to have to deal with jerks. And I thought that if I gave him a quote, he'd just leave me alone. So I gave him one. Let me read from his story about my house and what I sold it for and that I live in a three flat and I'm not telling him. I'll just read from his story. Quote, asked for comment this morning, Kass said, quote, I sold my house, period, and I moved to the city, period. You can quote me saying the word, period. And he did. He quoted me accurately. So that's all I can ask for. I told you he was a good guy. Did you have a nice Memorial Day? Did you miss the parades honoring the war dead who died so we could be free? Mayor Lightfoot says she might let us go to church someday on a Sunday, but she has to think about it. Lightfoot and Governor J.B. Pritzker are rubbing people the wrong way. According to them, you can't open your restaurant, but if you do, you can only have 25% of the seating available. But then they want 100% of the taxes. How's that fair? After JB was busted by Dane Placco on Fox Chicago, it was a great story for using Illinois construction companies to build his Wisconsin dream palace, you know, like Green Acres, but with a lot of, like, $3 million home. Tom Bevan on Twitter, you know Tom, he's been on the podcast with us. He runs Real Clear Politics. He started tweeting, that he's probably going to start calling him, instead of J.B. Pritzker, he'll call him Jackass Billionaire. Bevan said that he'll have to charge me if I want to use that one. Over the weekend, Betty wanted to do a few errands, get some groceries, and so I drove. She put her mask on and went in the store, and I stayed outside by the car. And I was just minding my own business and thinking about what I'd tell you today. And then a guy wearing a Don't Crap Me t-shirt, missing a few teeth, came up, and he was looking at me, pointing at me. He's about my age. "Hey," he said, "I know you. I know you," he said. "It's the shape of your head. I know you from somewhere. Where do I know you from? It's that head of yours." And I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, no. Oh, no. Please, no. What could I do? He said, "I know you." He's pointing his finger. And I said, "Yeah, it's me." And he said, "I thought it was you. You went to Taft, right? Your name's Mikey. We were in woodshop together." And as he got out of his car, he came over and I slipped my mask on, you know, to cover it, but to protect myself against coronavirus, really to cover my face. And I just shrugged at everything he said. "It was that business class we were in," he said. "Oh, yeah, I hated that one," I said, threw my mask, edging away. "Yeah, that sucked," he said. "What was that teacher's name?" "Oh, I forgot," I said. "I forgot. Long time ago." "Okay, yeah, see ya. Yeah, see ya," I said. So what do we talk about today? Restaurants? Economy? How's Lightfoot and Pritzker handling things? We've got the right guy to talk to, my friend Paul Vallis. He should have been governor. He ran for mayor, too. And he's here to talk about how Lightfoot is handling things. And Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokon Show on WGN, is here as always. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, and member of its editorial board. And where are you asking the government if you can take Holy Communion? Yeah, you're basically asking the mayor if you can take Holy Communion and the governor. They demand your taxes, but they won't let you work or go to church. Where is this place? It's the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, we're talking to the guy who should have been governor and would have made a good mayor, Paul Vallis, former CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, a man who was betrayed by media and the Democratic Party that wanted Rod Blagojevich. You're a guest on the Chicago Way. Hello, Paul.
Hi, John. Thank you. Thank you for those compliments.
So, Paul, before we get into policy and risk management and the hysteria of some of our elected officials, people should remember that Paul Vallis and his brother Dean worked in the family restaurants in Chicago when they were kids. And what is it like? Because we have so many experts in government and media who've never run a restaurant or worked in one. Tell us what it's like to actually work in a restaurant. What was it like in your dad's
place? Well, in the restaurant business, it's a 24/7 business, as you all know. And I say that, not that the restaurant's open that many hours, but, you know, we were open from 6 in the morning to 10 at night, and then we went home to bed. And then we came back to the restaurant. So, you know, so for all practical purposes, most of our days were consumed in the restaurant. And of course, we worked 7 days a week, and weekends and holidays were sometimes our biggest days. I mean, those were the days when we, when a lot of times we paid our bills and were able to secure our small profit margins. And so it is a tough business, and it's a very marginal business because, you know, restaurants, I was in the restaurant. We were in the restaurant business, and I worked in the restaurant in the and of course in the 70s during the Carter years and the early part of the Reagan years when inflation skyrocketed. And obviously, then it was brought under control. But the bottom line is, you know, we had inflation just skyrocketing, and of course, you know, you can't change your prices, you can't change your menus. You know, the restaurants absorb all those economic bumps in the road, so to speak.
I worked in a banquet hall once, and I had to serve the girl I loved who was going to the prom with somebody else. It was my big teenage drama of a while. But when you work in those kinds of businesses, me in the store, you guys in the restaurants, you get to learn to read people at an early age, right? I think that's kind of like a university, and it's important. But I need to ask about the economics, because I don't know why they just don't open and say, to hell with you guys, you know, to hell with you, Pritzker, to hell with you, Mayor. I'm opening. But they're afraid because they don't want to lose their licenses and all sorts of, you know, government pressure upon them. Give me the economics of it, Paul. If I have a restaurant that has 100 tables and I have my property taxes, my utilities, all that to pay, employees, et cetera. And then you tell me, as the government tells me, the overlords, the technocrati who run the world now, or at least this country, and you tell me I can only have 15% of tables outside. How am I supposed to pay my property taxes? How am I supposed
to? Look, a lot of these businesses are not going to survive. A lot of the retail businesses are going to be crushed permanently, particularly with the in the new normal. I don't think society is ever going to be ever going to change in the way we react to things. You know, I'm not trying to minimize the healthcare issues involving the pandemic. And, you know, the problem is you can't talk about reopening the economy or talk about the need for government to come up with a plan to reopen the economy in a safe way without somebody accusing you of trying to jeopardize somebody's healthcare. But look, there's a direct relationship between the quality of your self-quarantine and the amount of income. And that's not criticizing people who are upper income, and that's not to create a kind of a sense of class warfare. But the bottom line is the poor are being impacted the most, those marginal businesses, those retail businesses, those businesses that pay a large portion, if not the bulk, of the city's special taxes, where sales taxes are generated, where transaction taxes are generated, et cetera, you know. I mean, those businesses are being impacted, and those are marginal businesses. Being able to open them up to 20% of their employees or 30% or 20% capacity or 30% capacity, those businesses are just not going to survive. And still requiring that they pay their property taxes, their very high property taxes, because as you know, Cook County has property tax classification. So for industrial, commercial property, the assessments are actually higher, although as we've learned, you know, the assessor in the past has certainly exhibited some favoritism when it comes to certain commercial and industrial taxpayers. But the bottom line is these are the businesses that see a lot of turnover anyway. So there is going to be an impact. And the poor are being adversely impacted the most, because not only are they the ones who have the businesses that operate on the slimmest of margins, but these are also the individuals that are working or make up a disproportionate number of individuals that are working in those businesses and that are working in jobs that do not require specialized skills.
Last week, I wrote a column about the two classes of people in America now in coronavirus time. And particularly, this applies to the lockdown states like Illinois. We've got the technocrats, and I include journalists in this, people who can make a living at a laptop in their home, right? And then there are the people who used to work with their hands, the people that live around Pichek's Bakery on 55th and Narragansett. They're tradesmen. They work in cleaning crews. They do all this, you know, plumbers. They do all this stuff. When they want to go to work, they are mocked by the technocrat party and their useful idiots on Twitter. And they're told, oh, you want people to die. You're so selfish. And they're getting paid. Or they're SEIU people, or they're working for, you know, the state and the city, and they just sit on their ass because they're not really working. I'm not talking about cops firemen, first responders, and paramedics like Pat or anything. And this kind of mocking and classism is building up, and people are getting really angry about it. They want to work. How does what happens when you have these two classes? The people who want to work don't have a voice, and the technocrats have the voice and the control of the message. What happens as a result of this over time?
If you ever wanted to amplify class distinctions, this pandemic is doing it, because we are only widening the divide. Let's take, for instance, education. Do not underestimate the severe damage, the permanent damage that is being done having poor children that don't have the home resources, that maybe lack the home stability. Poor children may be being raised by a single parent with more than one child in the household. Do not underestimate the adverse impact prolonged absence from school is having. And the younger the children, the greater the impact, the greater the damage that is being done. Because schools are also centers of social service support. It's just not academic, it's social, emotional. So there's permanent impact. You know, I saw a study the other day that said that during a summer break, children lose about 20% of the knowledge that they picked up during the course of the year. Imagine what a 5-month or almost a 6-month absence from school, what the impact that is having on children, just not academically, but also social, emotionally. You know, what's happening is you have a phenomenon called brain atrophy. And that's what's happening. It's going to impact the poor the most. Look, we have parents, I've talked to parents, affluent parents, who are struggling to help their child at home with the online education and things like that. And the quality of the online education is directly linked to the wealth of the school district and the family income. And that's not disparaging in any way individuals who can provide more support for their family. That's not what this is about. There are other people who want to play the class war, not me. But the bottom line is, even those families, the children in those families are suffering too. So there's serious, serious damage to be done here. If anything, the schools should be mobilized to build their capacity to provide remote instruction. I of course, have articulated a strategy for reopening schools so that they're as healthy and as safe as they possibly can be. But clearly, I mean, every teacher should be going through training this summer on how to teach remotely, and just not send assignments home remotely, but to make sure that the homes have the devices and have the teachers interacting with the children online at home. I mean, that's what we should be gearing up. That's what we should be motivated and mobilizing to do, because the damage that is done is going to be permanent, and you're going to see the casualties in rising crime. You're going to see the casualties in individuals with social emotional problems, and all the repercussions that has on society. You know, look, there's nothing more racist, okay, so let me use the term racist, and then threatening Chicago's poorest, most deprived and neglected communities with fines and even arrests, so the very communities that are most adversely impacted by the massive job loss, the prolonged school closures, and the lack of resources are, in fact, those poorest communities. So we just have to be cognizant of that. It's like there's no nuance. It's like we got individuals competing over who's going to be tougher on shutting down the economy and who's going to be slower about reopening the economy. It becomes a leadership issue. And believe me when I say the long-term damage is going to be permanent.
Paul Vallis had just laid out, responsibly, the challenges facing government in Illinois. And I ask you both, I'm hearing that in Wisconsin and in Indiana, real estate people are being deluged by requests from Illinois companies, Illinois business, to find space in their states where they can open. They're not all restaurant guys. You know, you're not going to move your restaurant away from your customers, but other small businesses are going. When the flood of coronavirus and the fear porn recede, and we can see what's left, what are we going to see? How many businesses and jobs will be going to, beyond Illinois' borders, Jeff?
That's the scariest thing, because it feels like Pritzker and, as you'd call the technocrats who are running this state, they have no regard for small business. I talked about this last time, that there's this idea that anybody who has an income of over $100,000 is automatically you know, the bourgeoisie, evil, right? Right. They don't deserve to
consideration,
right? And you're right. There's no reason for them to stay here. I mean, the pride in Illinois, especially once we try to look past this and all the problems that await us on the other side. Yeah, there's no way. If I own a business, I was selling widgets, I would move to Indiana in a heartbeat or Wisconsin in a heartbeat.
Yeah, on your issue of exporting jobs and businesses to neighboring states, look, that was a serious problem before the pandemic, and it's only going to get worse and it's going to be magnified because, you know, Illinois is among the most aggressive states about with the lockdown. With the shutting down of the economy. But
of course it is, because this is the state where people have been taught, the populace has been taught to bow your head to the boss. No one's, the pushback is coming from me and a couple other people, you know, and protesters who are called Nazis. But most people bow their heads to it.
What we're talking about is bringing some sanity to this process and developing a practical strategy on the reopening of the economy with the proper, you know, health and safety measures intact. And, you know, when people criticize people for shutting things down, for being more aggressive, it doesn't mean that we're walking around with M16s or, you know, or showing up on Capitol steps and doing the crazy things that you know, obviously a lot of people are doing or they're using the pandemic to do. It's a practical question. It's what if the pandemic comes back? Are we going to go borrow another $3 trillion? Because, you know, the money that the federal government has borrowed in order to provide for the initial relief equals 25-30% of the value of all the companies traded on the S&P. I mean, think about that for a second. And now they want to borrow another $3 trillion. I mean, at some point, the debt that we're imposing on the next generation, or indeed the implications of imposing that debt on the existing generation, is going to be absolutely devastating. And it's going to impede our ability to do other things that this country needs. So you can't shut the economy down permanently or for extended periods of time without significant repercussions, the repercussions of which are going to be far greater than the direct healthcare repercussions of the pandemic. So you've got to have a strategy. You've got to have a plan. And look, you know, I'm not minimizing the problems that we're facing in the city or in the state or in this country. But what I'm saying is we need a comprehensive plan, and it's got to be more than just some mathematical rubrics that says when you reach this percentage of testing, these things are going to happen. I mean, are there business people at the table? Are these reopening formulas being developed with input from people who have built businesses and who have managed businesses? I mean, the bottom line here is we can't be kind of arbitrary. My fear is that they are going to slowly and gradually reopen, but when they reopen, they're not going to be prepared. And then when the virus spikes, as it is likely to, particularly if they don't have obviously a vaccine, then they'll put the economy in shutdown again. And then things are going to get worse. Because right now, it's as if we're on a ship and it hit an iceberg and everybody's in the water. And what we're doing is we're not getting them out of the water. We're just giving them another life preserver and another life preserver and another life preserver. And that's what these federal relief acts are. And pretty soon we're going to run out of life preservers because we will have borrowed ourselves into oblivion.
And then I guess we can ask the Chinese, like, how we can run our country, because they're the ones buying our debt.
John, when you got Saudi Arabia now bailing out Boeing, ponder that for a second. Or the fact that the Chinese are the largest holders of our debt. Who finances our borrowing? So ponder that for a while. And so clearly there are implications. But look, it's a hard job, and I'm not quite in any way questioning people's motives. But what I'm going to do, and I'm going to continue to do, is to offer ideas and suggestions and recommendations on how to reopen schools, how to build a school's capacity to do, first of all, screening at home, then screening and temperature taking at schools, and then even testing at schools. I mean, the other day, Sean Penn came to town, and, you know, I'm on the board of Sean Penn's organization, CORE. In fact, I'm the finance chair. And the city announced with great fanfare that they were opening 5 testing centers. Well, 5 testing centers, that's great. There's 2.7 million people in the city. That testing model could, you could have 20 or 30 or 40 of those testing models. You could do that type of testing on a school campus. And the costs of that testing are Medicaid reimbursable, particularly if you're serving a population when you provide testing for individuals who from families who live below the poverty level. So the bottom line is we need to develop a comprehensive, I'm not saying open schools irresponsibly, I'm saying let's come up with a comprehensive plan to reopen schools and to keep them open, and in the process make sure that we've got the infrastructure in place so that we can ensure proper health and safety, and that we continue to upgrade our ability to provide remote instruction in the event that things are that schools get shut down again, but also in the event that if students do test positive or if students have fevers at home and their mothers are keeping them at home from school because our policy is going to be temperature check your child, and don't send your child to school if he or she has a fever, we're going to have to provide that child with remote instruction. So we need to prepare for the new normal. And that means everything's off the table. Contractual agreements, et cetera, that's all suspended until we come up with a strategy on how, because at the end of the day, taxpayers are still paying their taxes. People are still going to pay their property taxes this year, and they need to see results. And right now, the results that they're getting are not results that they are in any way satisfied with.
Teach your children well. Their fathers have. It slowly go by and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.
And Paul, you know, while we got you, I really got to ask you, but we just passed, obviously, the first year marker for Mayor Lightfoot. Give me your take on that year.
Yeah, look, you know, I think that, she definitely has demonstrated the capacity for decisive decision making. And she certainly has found a way to get her agenda through the council. I mean, there's some dissent within the council and things like that. That's, you know, I wish the council had a greater capacity for independent thought. In other words, you know, the council doesn't really have the capacity to independently analyze and evaluate programs and initiatives and things like that. I don't believe that there has been a significant improvement in transparency. I mean, certainly the last budget wasn't too transparent. But at the end of the day, I believe that she's been working to assemble a good team, and I think she has the ability to build a consensus and to make the decisions that need to be made in real time to get the city moving forward. The question is going to be, what are we going to do now? We've had our first year stopgap budget. We now have our pandemic. Well, what are the next steps? I mean, what are we going to do to develop a long-term financial plan for the city and not just wait for the federal government to kind of bail us out to get us through a second budget year? Because there needs to be some sort of long-term planning, and I don't see it so far. And finally, great. We've been decisive about shutting down the economy and mandating that people engage in the proper behavior, social distancing, et cetera. She's certainly gotten a lot of publicity on that. Maybe my approach might have been different, but the bottom line is, where do we go from here? The economy cannot remain closed permanently. So what are we going to do to get this economy open and to keep this economy open? How are we going to change things? How are we going to change the way we do things so that kids can get back to school, can get back into school, businesses can open, and marginal businesses can continue to survive? You know, but I think she clearly has the skills, and she is a decisive leader in that regard. So I think she has the capacity to develop and sell a plan, a long-term financial plan for the city, and to develop and sell a long-term strategy for opening the economy and making sure that we've got the proper procedures and protocols in place so that we can keep the economy open.
You know what? This podcast, we're taping this on Friday, and just as we began to tape, Joe Biden put both feet in his mouth and came out with another race-baiting comment. And this one wasn't Bush is going to put y'all back in chains. This one's even worse. He defines the white guy, the old white guy who fought Corn Pop in his dreams, is now telling black men how to be black.
Joe Biden this morning, as we were taping this, was in an interview with Charlamagne Tha God, a well-known rapper and producer.
Oh, God.
Yes, and he was pressed on why he was considering Amy Klobuchar, and Charlamagne pressed him on black voters and why what that says to black voters.
Listen, you got to come see us when you come to New York, VP Biden.
I will.
It's a long way until November. We got more questions.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
It don't have nothing to do with Trump. It has to do with the fact I want something for my community. I would love to see
you. Take a look at my record, man. I extended the voting rights 25 years. I have a record that is second to none. The NAACP has endorsed me every time I've run. Come on. Take a look at the record.
You know, I've been critical of you. I have a few things I want to talk to you about.
I know you have.
Yeah.
You don't know me.
No, I don't. That's why I want to get to know you today. I want to talk to you about mostly black stuff.
I get overwhelming support from the black leadership, young and old. Every poll shows me way ahead.
And black people saved your political life in the primaries this year. They have things they want from you. And one of them is a black woman running mate. What do you say to them?
What I say to them is that I'm not acknowledging anybody who is being considered, but I guarantee you there are multiple black women being considered.
Paul Bellis. You were in politics. You elected. You ran for public office. Tell us what you think of Joe Biden's. If you don't vote for me, you ain't black.
Oh well, I'll let Joe explain that one.
That's not good enough. This is the Chicago way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very insulting and condescending. And, not only what he said, but the way he said it and the manner that he said it. But that won't be the first time that he's kind of gone off the rails. And that probably won't be the last time.
There'll be the Joe Biden's greatest hits.
Yeah.
Bush will put y'all back, or Romney will put y'all back in chains. It was Romney, not Bush. His discussions with how Herman Talmadge loved him.
Well, suffice to say, I think there could have been a more careful response to why the African American community should support a Joe Biden ticket if he has Amy on the ticket. So, talking about the wrong answer and the wrong delivery.
The only one I feel sorry for is Amy Klobuchar in this. But in this instance, but you know what? It does speak to a larger issue. I would say the racism of the technocracy, the white technocracy of the Democratic Party, always manipulating African-American sentiment. And as if they think, and they've proven they think, that black people are stupid. You'll have... Jeff Carlin, you're going to have your typical, you can have an African-American chorus of pundits who will try to support it or not based on race. But I just think that the insult to human dignity, telling people what they should think or not think based on the color of their skin is just...
John, I think what's really important is, you can criticize Joe Biden for making those remarks and not be out there supporting Trump. I mean, the problem is when you criticize people, they try to force you into two camps. There's like no nuance. Like, just the discussion we had about reopening the economy. It's not a question of health versus economics. We all know the long-term casualties that occur when you have a crumbling economy. So at the end of the day, the Democrats...
And the poorest people suffer.
The poorest people suffer. It's as simple as that. And look, the Democratic Party has taken African-American voters for granted, period. That's just a fact. It just is. And that doesn't mean that that I'm a Trump supporter or that we're out there pushing for Trump.
I know you're not. And I know I've had enough conversations with you to know that you think what you think about Trump's manner and his personality and his leadership style. And it's not all positive from Paul Vallis. But here's the thing. I've said the same. And what drives me crazy is when I see stuff like this and the inevitable defense of Biden by African American Kamalist pundits to protect him, or the hagiography of that ridiculous Washington Post profile showing the Stacey Adams backlit in a diaphanous gown, and she only has been a state representative. She hasn't won any other office. It's just a face and a voice, but she's African American, so I guess they love her. They want her to be the next vice president. In Biden's case, that means president. All that stuff, where the Nancy Pelosi telling people that she's on the side of the Holy Spirit. Remember, it was just a few days ago. All that drives people into the other camp. It's not that people love Trump. It's that they can't stand that other side.
The divide, and it is a great divide. And just as the divide between rich and poor, between the affluent and those who are in need, between those who are well-educated and those who struggle to get a quality education, well, the pandemic is going to widen that divide significantly and permanently. It's also going to continue, I believe, to widen the political divide, because we're going to find ourselves shouting at each other. I mean, clearly there are factions on the one side who want to use the shutdown as some sort of major infringement on people's civil liberties and without at least...
Well, that's because it is.
Yeah, but my point is, without appreciating, and I'm saying some individuals, without appreciating that there are people in the other side who have genuine concerns about the pandemic and about the spread of the virus and about taking precautions so you're not spreading the virus to someone who wants to follow proper procedures, so to speak. And then, of course, you have people, obviously, on the other side who view anyone who wants to talk about reopening the economy because of the destructive impact it's having on the nation as a whole, but in particular on its poorest citizens, as somehow individual, as somehow being right-wingers who want to be irresponsible.
Want you to die. Right.
I want to throw in two, and before we let you go, Paul, you've seen this, and it's not that it's not true, but there's been a lot of emphasis on how bad the coronavirus and the COVID has been for the black and brown communities, using Newspeak, as John has told us.
Right.
Exactly. That they're going to be sold, those groups, they're going to be sold the bill that this was so bad. This was so bad. This was so bad. And whose fault was it? It was the guy in the big White House. He's the one who didn't let your friends die, who let your relatives die. And the reality is that it's Democratic policies up to this point that put people in poorer, lower education, less healthy populations that were densely populated in areas that were neglected by multiple cities across the country that have led to the situation in those deaths. And it had nothing to do with the president's handling of this, because he didn't create this glut of underlying health conditions and lack of information and education to these communities. But he's going to wear it as a crown of thorns because the media and Biden and liberal powerhouses are going to lay that on his head.
Jeff Carlin, are you an editor? That's awesome. That's the kind of discussion I would like to have with an editor, before I write.
Yes.
Well, look, one of the reasons that I ran for mayor was, and I supported Lori Lightfoot the night of the primary. I didn't try to negotiate or whatever, or have a meeting or have a discussion. I said I was going to support the individual who entered the race before Rahm Emanuel got out, and I felt that she was a qualified candidate, and I still believe that she'll do a good job. My recommendations aside, are some of my comments aside. I still think she has the ability and the skills to lead the city. But the bottom line is, one of the reasons I stayed in the race was because the whole prospect that we would get another Daley for 4 to 8 years was or we might get a Chico or some of these other people, it was just unacceptable to me. This is a city that in 1970, 50% of the city's population in 1970 was considered middle class. Today, I think it's 15% of the city's population is considered middle class. WBEZ did a study on that. And we've gone from something like 42% of the city coming from being lower income to something like 62%. You know, think about that for a second. That's been under Democratic leadership. Look at what's happened. We've become a tale of two cities. And look, we haven't even begun, John, to address the other pandemic, the man-made pandemic that exists in our society. And I'm just not talking about the implications from providing uneven educational services in terms of quality, you know, to all social economic groups. I'm talking about just the environmental issues. I mean, yeah. We still don't have a strategy to get to replace the lead pipes. We still have lead in the water, and you know, they talk about certain safe levels of lead, and like 25% of the households or whatever have unsafe levels based on these pilot testings that they've done. No amount of lead is safe for children. Or for that matter, go to the South Side, where you not only have problems with lead, but you have problems with manganese and other pollutants that are the byproduct of those shutdown steel mills and industrial plants. I mean, where's the environmental cleanup? Those areas have been contaminated for years. That's a
How does lead and manganese impact young minds, young brains that you try to educate for so many years?
Well, you know what lead does in terms of ADD, of course, social emotional. It has an impact on people's attention span, their temperament. It has a profound impact. And you know, if you live in Chicago, the life expectancy, Google it and go online. The difference is, depending on your zip code, depending on what neighborhood you live in, the life expectancy, the differences in life expectancy is as much as 15, 16, 17 years. That's in a city. You know, in some areas of the city, we have the life expectancy that they have in the Soviet Union with all its problems versus the life expectancy you see in Germany or in Sweden. Think about that for a second. If you live in Lincoln Park, your life expectancy is in the 80s, in the mid 80s. If you live on the south side of Chicago, it's in the high 60s. I mean, what if the pandemic created that type of contrast in life expectancies? We would probably keep the economy shut down permanently. So my point here is, we've got some serious problems. We've got a pandemic, and that's a man-made pandemic. Not cleaning up, not replacing those lead pipes, not coming up with a strategy to do environmental remediation, not coming up with a strategy to provide more social service support to those poorest communities, like reopening those mental health centers that we promised, that we all promised during the campaign. I mean, repairing and rebuilding the what I call community-based social service infrastructure. You want to use cannabis money the right way? Use the money to begin to rebuild social service infrastructure.
I blame you. Because if you had been elected governor instead of Blagojevich, who gave pension holidays, there'd be money. But now most of the money collected from the people who can't work because of Pritzker Lightfoot shutdown goes to deal with the pension holes in the pension obligation.
Well, look, our pension.
There's no money for that, for what you want.
Our pensions are disastrously funded. There's no doubt about it. But it's actually worse. It's actually worse than we realize, because the unfunded liabilities are based on optimistic projections that we're never going to hit, that we weren't going to hit even before the pandemic. And consider this for a second. Both the state systems combined and the local systems, not including the teachers, the city systems, I think the funding ratios are they have less than 5 years of, in effect, investments on hand versus annual payout. It's like a 5-to-1 ratio. That means, and it used to be, that ratio used to be 3 times as high 20 years ago for the combined systems. I think the teacher system is 8-to-9-to-1. And that's healthy ratios are 18, 19, 20-to-1. Well, what that means is eventually, if things continue to deteriorate, and the pandemic will only accelerate us down the road towards full bankruptcy, when it comes to our pension systems. Eventually, we're going to reach a point where we will be appropriating money each year to pay our employee pensions. In other words, we will be appropriating money not to put in the funds, but we'll be appropriating money to pay for pensions, because we will have reached a pay-as-you-go point. And when that happens, then we're already diverting a large percentage of our state and local budgets toward pension right now. 93% of the cities, of the property taxes that the city levies, that people pay in Chicago for city property taxes, not schools, but city property taxes, go to either pensions or to finance long-term debt. We're really well along the road towards economic and financial destruction here if we don't start changing our policies and changing our approaches really fast. So this is a real crisis situation.
Idaho and Wyoming, maybe even Indiana, start looking good to me now, man, after listening to that. For Paul Vallis, the man who should have been governor, maybe even mayor, but you didn't want him because you wanted to listen to nonsense from the machine and all the hacks that shut you down now. And from Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokot Show on WGN. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune and a member of its editorial board. This is the Chicago Way. Join us again next time, won't you?